Test, one, two.
No problem.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am State Representative Gwen Clark Reed, and I am the Chair of the Broward Legislative Delegation. As you can see, some of our members have, who said they were coming, have not arrived as yet, but I know that your time is valuable, and as the Chair, I can report back to the rest of the delegation as to what your interests are and your issues are. We will be recording this meeting so that we can go back, if need be, and look at your issues. At this time, I am going to stand and ask everyone to stand with me and to pledge to the flag of the United States.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please be seated. At this time, I'm going to ask my good friend and my landlord, Mayor Lamar Fisher, to come forward and to greet you. Thank you.
I love you being a landlord. I wish you could stay there forever.
I hope I can.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the great city of Pompano Beach. We are honored and privileged to host this event here this afternoon for you. Again, as State Representative Gwen Clark Reed said, I hope other folks will show up to assist and help in what your needs are and also to hear the speakers. I would be remiss without saying hello to my dear friend Barbara. Where's Barbara at? Barbara Weinstein, thank you so much for being here today, Spirit. We love you. We love you too. To everybody who's here in the Broward and the Boys and Girls Club, thank you for coming out, Ryan, as well. Anything we can do to make your visit better, let us know. We have a great staff right outside here at the EPAT Larkin Center, one of our three community centers we have throughout the city of Pompano Beach. We are a thriving community, and thank goodness to our State Representative Gwen Clark Reed. She has been awesome to us, and we will miss her. Hopefully she'll be up there soon in another capacity, but anyway, anything we can do to help, just ask, and we're here to help. God bless you.
Thank you very much, Mayor Fisher. At this time, we are going to invite, is Commissioner Phillips here? Okay, if he should come in, we would definitely ask him to greet you also. Thank you, Representative Rogers. Appreciate it.
I'm bringing the troops.
You're bringing the troops. The troops are coming in. All right. Thank you. We are about to get to the public hearing portion of our meeting. All speakers will be allotted 3 to 5 minutes for their presentation. As of now, we have 18 speakers. We would appreciate your cooperation in turning off your cell phones or putting them on vibrate so that we will not be interrupted by telephones ringing. Thank you. If there is anyone else in the audience who is interested in speaking to the legislative delegation and who has not previously signed up, please fill out a speaker's form and submit it to Faith Lombardo. After each person speaks, the members of the delegation will be provided time to ask questions. Okay, is there any question about the sign up? All right, thank you very much. And we're going to get started right away with our Executive Director, the Aging and Disabilities Resource Center of Broward County, none other than Edith Lederberg.
Good thing is you have two of my favorite legislators up here. I just said, hey, so you better show up. You better be at the end of it.
Senator Smith.
You represent all of the aging programs in Broward County. And right now we have 394,180 residents over the age of 60, which is fine as long as they have money and can contribute to the economy in the county and in the state, but they become older and more dependent, and we're here to try to help them. So like everybody else in the room, we talk about money, community care for the elderly, which is state funding for senior services, which started back in 1977 when I came on staff. Bob Graham noticed that his father-in-law had a debilitating illness and there were very few services for frail elders. So it goes way back. And the state has been very good about putting money into community care for the elderly, which is a lot cheaper than paying for people to be in nursing homes. So that's a big issue with us, increased funding for community care for the elderly. Our lead agency for that program is here, that's Andrea Basada. The county is our lead agency, and they're very good with their money. I know Representative Rogers was our commissioner in Lauderdale Lake. She made certain that they provided fair share matching funds. This is one of the very few organizations in the county that has mandated local match. And Alzheimer's disease initiative started when Bill Clark from Broward County was the state representative, and Carrie Meek was the senator from Dade County, and the two of them got together and decided there should be money for Alzheimer's services. And they got money from the state, these are state programs. They got money for respite, and it was in-home respite. I spoke to Bill Clark, and we got them to allow us to use that money for daycare as well. So that's a wonderful program as well. And the figures are all on these. I guess my finance director is here with the packets that we were dropping off, because we're not going to carry them back. Senator Smith, congratulations on being elected vice chair. It was a great chair, and Gwendolyn. The other issue is local service program dollars. Back in 1987, the director of aging and all services for the state decided to change the formula of distributing federal money. So I said, how would you like to increase? And I said, where would you get it from? They said, Dade County, they're historically overfunded. So the same thing to my friends in St. Petersburg. And I said, wait till we get more money. Well, we never got more money from the feds. We haven't had an increase since 1986. That was the date. And what happened was Dade County said, if you take money from us, we're going to sue you. And they went ahead, they changed the formula. Dade County sued. They had a federal case in Dade County. They won the lawsuit. So instead of getting money, we lost $825,000. And my friend up in Pasco in Pinellas County was $1.25 million. The state graciously, the state legislature appropriated those monies for us. But over the years, they've been whittled away. And so our projects are suffering because they don't get those monies. We put new programs on in Broward County with local service program dollars. Hosnack Center Kosher Food Program, Austin Hepburn Center got some of those monies. Cantor Center and Sunrise got some of those monies as well. But we are desperately in need of those funds. But those are our prime issues. The State Association of Area Agencies on Aging, now we're called Aging Disability Resource Center, all have signed on for this. So is the Florida Council on Aging. President is Andrea Basada, and she's here, signed on in support of the same issues. The other one is an increase in Medicaid managed care dollars. There's $1.3 million in there for this year. That goes, we're assigned with very little admin monies, the responsibility of helping people on Medicaid access services. Every year, it's not automatically in the budget. This year, both the Department of Elder Affairs, it looks like the governor as well, we hope he leaves it in there, have signed on to support those monies. That's about all I have to share. Those issues are all explained in these pages, and I think we're preaching to the choir. You know, Senator Smith sits on Health and Human Services in the Senate with Eleanor Sobel, who was chair, I think, last year. And the two of you have always been very supportive. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Edith, for your presentation. And you know that where our passions lie as far as the elderly are concerned, at least mine, I'm in the same boat with you. Okay?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Smith, I want to introduce you that you had arrived. And thank you very much for coming. Go right ahead and ask your question.
Quick question about the governor's office, and I guess statewide. Who's working the governor's office? Have you guys band together? Because as you know, we fight hard to get the money in the budget every year in worthwhile projects. And this governor in the past 2 years, especially last year, as you well know, has just callously taken money out of the budget. Do we have a statewide tactic, or what are we doing to ensure that he Kingston's money in.
The key organizations dealing with aging services around the state are behind this. We have Robert Beck, who's the lobbyist in Tallahassee. I think some of you have met him. I've asked him to stop into your offices. Last year, the governor had a turnover in a lot of his staff. He wasn't even aware of these Medicaid monies and how important they were, because we had to hire a lot of staff to deal with the problems he had caused every day, all day long. And he is apprised of it, and he did, finally, at the end last year, he did approve those monies, so hoping he keeps them in this year.
Thank you, Edith. Anyone else with a question? Rev. Rogers, do you have a question?
I'm good.
Thank you very much, Edith, for your presentation. Next on the agenda, Dr. Barbara Weinstein, President and CEO of Family Central, Inc.
Good afternoon. I want to thank the three of you and commend you for being here today. You are three that I count on every year up in Tallahassee, and I'm grateful to be able to speak today. I'm going to be brief. We have a few favors to ask of the legislature. Number one, and I know my partner here who is sitting in this auditorium will agree with me, we need to have an increase in funding for child welfare case management services. There isn't enough. We are being overburdened with children and families that are coming into this state that need services. It is serious, and the cases that we are getting that are coming into us, more and more are coming to the courts from BSO. I told them that we picked up a child last week who had been beaten badly because his mother did not realize that he was autistic, and she thought that he was stupid. We need to have workers in the field working with these families to ensure that these children are cared for and that parents have the support that they need in order to ensure these children survive. We also need to reduce the caseload of the caseworkers. There are too many cases. They can't do what needs to be done for these children because the caseload is just too high. If you have an emergency or an accident, or God forbid, two children at the same time that need the same caseworker, we're in trouble because of the numbers of children that are coming into the system. I need your help in these two issues, and I have two other things that I would like to ask your support. Family Central is the agency that supplies food for low-income children in South Florida. We are daily providing 45,000 meals to low-income children every single day, 5 days a week, breakfast, lunch, and a snack. We need your help in convincing the Department of Health and the congressional delegation that these children need dinner. Many of them don't have another meal when they go home. They're hungry. If you see them when they come in Monday morning, they're hungry. I talked to an administrator in the school system this year that is giving out free lunches in the high school. You can't imagine how many children are coming into high school hungry. We need to make sure that these children are fed and cared for. We are very worried about what's going to happen to these children. We are not doing the greatest job that we could in making sure that they are safe and protected. I ask you to help me make sure that there is proper funding for case management, that we have an increase in the BPK rate. The providers cannot do the job in the rate that they are being paid. It's way too low. And I will tell you, a lot of parents are very concerned because the 540 hours or the 3 hours a day that they're getting gives them a major headache because they don't know what to do with the children the other time that they can't afford to keep them in the child care facility or the school system where they are during the day. I know that it's a tough road up in Tallahassee. I understand that. But you are three heroes, and I charge you to help me make sure that the children of Florida have an opportunity to survive and thrive and reach their potential. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weinstein. Panel, any questions, members? Senator Smith?
Just a quick question. What are the reimbursement rates for the childcare? What are those things?
For BPK?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They're about $2,700 to $2,800. Mm-hmm. It's not enough. It really isn't. We're paying the people that work in the child care facilities that teach BPK, and I was in a center this morning. They're barely getting minimum wage, and they're not getting any benefits. So there's no health insurance, there's nothing that they are getting. And the operators of the schools cannot afford to keep these kids in care and pay rent and pay expenses at the rate that the state is paying.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Rogers.
Thank you. Thank you very much for all you do, for your passion, for what you do. But I'm at a point that we need to learn to help ourselves. So I'm going to make a statement. The reason we are pushing for $15 an hour instead of minimum wage of $8.05 is because we want families to be able to take care of themselves and feed themselves. Then we won't need all these free services here. I know we have the Children's Services Council. I know this is a grant. I will call when you first got your funding. For us to even engage a nonprofit, we had to go visit the location to make sure they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, and then we would grant them some funding through various programs of the Children's Services Council. Can you tell me what programs that you do with children, especially in the VP cases, is so critical? Because we need those kids. We are fighting at the state level for increased hours. The 3 hours we recognize is not enough. So is there any partnership that could be created to extend those hours from 3 to even more, like you're advocating for? Where are my partners? And as we speak to, we know some schools currently do provide on a Friday a backpack or a book, whatever it is, with food, but that is still not the solution to that problem, but we don't want to not provide. What are we doing to coordinate with some of our local churches on some of these projects to be self-supporting, you know, because Tallahassee is tough. So coming to me every year asking for the same things, and for me not seeing any new project engaging the local community, tell me of some of those good things that you have been doing in lieu of what we are able to provide, because I'm going to fight for you, like we always do. But in the meantime, we still have the problem. How can we engage locally to resolve it?
We're doing a couple of things, I think, that are new and different. We know that there's a separation of church and state. We understand that. But about 8 or 9 months ago, we put together a clergy board. We now have over 40 clergy in the Broward County area that have adopted a family. I will tell you that Pastor Grimes and Rabbi Boxman are the two that are heading up this project. They have been outstanding. They are adopting families, visiting homes. In fact, Rabbi Boxman was in a home this morning with one of our clients, seeing how we could help giving them a hand up, not a hand out. Do they need education? Do they need to learn English? Do they need to know how to write a check? Do they need money for transportation? Do they need a car? All of these things we're working on. Also, we're working with the families to ensure that they have the tools to make sure their children do well. We are going into the homes, and we have a program called Home Instruction for Parents of Preschool Youngsters, that where the coach goes into the home, works with the family, finds out what their needs are, and brings it back to us. The other thing that we are doing is I have a meeting next week. I went to see David Lawrence, and many of you know who he is. Mm-hmm. I went to see David, and I spoke to the two people in the children's movement, and I said, David, one of the things that we need to do is bring their partners to the table. We're all operating in silos. Mm-hmm. We are working together and talking to each other, but we need to make sure that we have a game plan. So I am meeting with Jorge today and Vance. I never can pronounce his last name. I want to say Acropolis, but I know that's wrong. I am meeting with them next week to see if we can put together a committee statewide that will look at the resources that we need in order to get these families to be self-sufficient. You're absolutely 100% correct.
Thank you.
And the families that we serve, they are looking to be self-sufficient. They're not looking for a handout. They are absolutely looking to be able to manage their lives on their own without all the messing in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weinstein. Representative Bobby DeBose has joined us. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you to all of you. I'm very grateful.
Yes, and I would just want to say, Dr. Weinstein, every time I get on the floor with Representative Fresen, I am always asking, where are the dollars for VPK and the need for the increase in the funding for VPK? And I will continue to do that.
And I have an appointment to see him, I think, in 3 weeks, so I'll make sure that I'm firm when I speak to him.
Please do. Thank you. Next on the agenda is Kim Grossman. Yeah, I know you have a problem with your last name. From the Florida Department of Children and Families, DCF Matters, yes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the delegation. Thank you for your interest in Health and Human Services. Yes, I'm Kim Gorsuch, and I'm the Community Development Administrator for DCF here in Broward County. Just wanted to take a few minutes to let you know we've been pretty busy over the last couple of years at DCF. I think you just got a packet of information that we prepared that you can read at your leisure. But I'm going to just hit on a few of the highlights of some of the data and information that's contained in that packet. In our economic self-sufficiency program, which I know several of you are very interested in, the Medicaid food assistance and TANF, all of those programs have seen increases in the last several years. There are now 293,000 individuals receiving Medicaid. That's a 27% increase overall, 32% increase in children receiving Medicaid, and 19% increase in adults. We see a lot of those that were shifted over to us from the marketplace. When people went to the federal marketplace to apply for benefits, they were not eligible there, and they shifted those cases over to us. So we attribute a fair amount of that growth in caseload to the federal marketplace. SNAP, on the other hand, has remained relatively constant at about, we've seen a modest, only 7% increase, despite the fact that we have about 180 to 200 community partners throughout the county where people can go and make application. We've got a special project going on where people can go and with one click on one electronic application, make application for about 6 or 8 different programs. So we're trying to get that word out there, and you know, as Dr. Weinstein just said, we know we've got kids that are hungry, but we just haven't seen the increase in that caseload that I might have expected. Our TANF or cash assistance caseload has remained relatively constant, and that has run pretty flat over the last many years. We never really see a whole lot of growth in that particular program. In Adult Protective Services, our program, which investigates allegations of abuse, neglect, or exploitation to the elderly and vulnerable adults, we've been running pretty consistent the last 2 years in that program with just under 300 cases per month. We have seen an increase in the number of verified cases, but we think some of that is attributed to actually a little bit better training with our staff on financial exploitation and some of those kinds of matters. In child welfare, however, the story is very different. The number of cases coming in for BSO to investigate has increased by 15% the last 2 years.
Kim, can I just say to the timekeeper, we are going to allow DCF 2 more minutes.
Yes.
Please, thank you.
I'll run quick. 15% increase in the number of cases coming in. Removals are up by 17%. That has resulted in the number of children in foster care in this community increasing by 76%. 76. From 1,264 to the end of last fiscal year, 2,226. Domestic violence and substance abuse are still the primary drivers that factor into why children are removed from their home. So that leads me to the department's number 1 and 2 requests for funding. $12.8 million funding in community substance abuse and mental health that would go to the managing entity, Broward Behavioral Health, here in Broward, for planning and procuring services in the community to keep kids from going into care, families from involvement in the child welfare system, as well as adults from going into jails and prisons and those kind of deep end expensive programs. The second priority is $7.4 million for case management for the community-based care agencies in the state, such as ChildNet. Barbara Weinstein mentioned that caseloads are high. They are very, very high with this amount of kids coming in and having to manage those cases. In addition, we've requested $6.5 million for CAT teams. Those are community action teams. Those would keep both adults and juveniles from entering into jails, prisons, mental health institutions, foster care, juvenile justice, you name it. I would ask that you consider supporting these initiatives, that they're very important, that we can keep the families in our community intact, kids with their homes where they belong, and folks out of jails and prisons. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representatives, are there any questions? Ms. Senators?
Quick question.
Yes, go right ahead, Senator.
You talked about the, I guess, the
working with the kids and the families on the mental health aspect. I've noticed a disturbing trend, and I want to know if you guys have seen this, that we've gotten more away from the counseling and more into the medicating. Do you monitor how much is counseling and how much is medicated? Or do you, in the services you provide, is that medicating or is that strictly family counseling?
Let me make sure I understand the question. You're talking about billing services to Medicaid?
No, with the grants which you're the pastor, I guess, to local organizations, you talked about that help with the counseling and stuff with the kids, and keeping the kids and the families and providing counseling to families. How much of that is counseling, and is any of that providing medication?
Medication. I'm going to probably defer that question to the behavioral health experts that are going to come behind me. But the vast majority of families, like I said, that come into contact with the child welfare system are straight out because of domestic violence and parents who are addicted to drugs. And they need treatment. They need substance abuse treatment. They need detox. They need inpatient. They need outpatient treatment. You know, the laws that changed the pill mills and shut those clinics were terrific. But addicts will do what addicts do. They will find the next drug of choice. And you see that with Flocka, our next epidemic on the horizon. People are still finding other drugs, and that interferes with their ability to safely take care of their children. Did that answer?
Yeah, and I guess people coming behind you will probably
answer. I think they maybe will.
All right. Thank you very much, Kim, for your presentation. You have a question? Yes. Representative DeBose.
Sorry. Just want to go back to the number that you gave, 76%, and he says increase in children now in foster care. Is that number continuing upward, or has it plateaued?
It's continuing to rise month after month after month.
Okay, and then my second question is, so where are these kids going?
Well, I know Monica King from ChildNet is coming up behind me. ChildNet has done a fabulous job in developing new foster homes. They lead the state in the creation of new foster homes and retention of foster homes, but it's not enough to keep up. We are in desperate need of loving families that will open their homes and let these kids come and be as much like their natural family as absolutely possible. It is a tremendous need right now.
And with that, this increase, this spiking, and it's, the rate is just off the charts, and childhood only has certain capacity. So what's the long-term objective? How are we, if it's continuing to go up and there's only a certain amount of capacity, talk to me of what we're doing or what's needed to address this issue.
We just last week had some meetings with the Casey Family Foundation. They're national experts in child welfare. We have asked them to come into Broward to work with us to review our child welfare system of care to determine, we do have the Children's Services Council that puts $9.7 million into front-end prevention and diversion services. We need to look at whether that's enough. Whether those programs are right to take families with really complex issues, with violence, domestic violence, and severe addiction issues, or whether we need to figure out ways we can fill some additional gaps. So we have brought in, we will be bringing in the national experts. I'm just getting ready to set that initial meeting and hope that they can help us. They've been involved in other jurisdictions in the state of Florida, as well as they have a very renowned national reputation for assisting.
Kim, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Rogers.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing with us, Oregon. It's really scary, the numbers that you're sharing. But I am going to play devil's advocate. Now, a foster home, tell me how you protect communities, then is it really that you want to take care of these children and bring them into your homes because you truly want to make a difference in that child's life? Or you're taking in these children and truly not taking care of them like you should? Who monitors that to make sure the kids that we have in foster homes and when they go into communities, are they behaving like my natural children? in those communities, or creating what some folks believe, you know, truly, I don't want this in my backyard, because we're not monitoring it, and we're not making sure the families who are taking children understand this is a family community, so if you're taking in additional children, you need to be able to control your children. So explain how you monitor making sure my children get a quality home.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. ChildNet has, over the past few years, engaged in a project called the Quality Parenting Initiative, where they have brought in trainers and modified their system so that we do get those parents who really want to, you know, have a good heart and are doing it for the right reasons. There, it would be hard to say people are motivated by the money, because quite frankly, it's not much money. So we do believe that we've got the right people that have opened their hearts. In terms of the monitoring, these are kids who have been victimized. They have been traumatized. And we know that as a result of trauma, it impacts their brain, it impacts their development. I mean, there's a whole body of research that we could talk about all night. The impact of that can also impact children's behavior. And so sometimes they will run away, sometimes they will act out, and sometimes they do get arrested. It's a fact of the children that we serve, they haven't come from perfect backgrounds, and as a result, they don't behave perfectly. We do the best we can to wrap them with services and treatment and interventions to deal with that trauma. We believe once we begin to heal that, that they will be on a better path to healing and better behavior as a result. But I will not stand here with a straight face today and tell you that every child that we have in care is a perfect child. Far from it.
Not our families. We're not perfect.
Our families, right.
All right. Thank you.
Kim, I understand that in our meeting last week in the mental health in Children, Families, and Elders Committee, that they're looking, when you say to provide services for the family, that the families are looking, the services to be provided are to find out what is in that family. Can that child stay in their natural setting rather than pulling that child out and putting them in foster care when they can be helped right in the home with their family? So I'm looking at the Casey Foundation coming in, because I know that is one of their objectives, is not to have all these children necessarily taken away from their families, but to work within that family so that that child can stay in the home, and reducing the number of children that we have going into foster care. So I'll be looking forward to that.
Right, and that FIT team that you funded last year, that for our behavioral health,
yes,
is just now getting, you know, going. The money came in the first of this fiscal year, will be a big help with that. And the CAT team that I mentioned, that is in our funding request this year, will also help that. So we hope to get that CAT team. A number of other communities got it the last couple of years, and Broward was left out, and so yeah, we're hoping to play catch up with some funding this year.
Thank you very much for your presentation and answering our questions. At this time, we will call Rocky Rodriguez and Sylvia Quintana, yes, from Broward Behavioral Health. And Senator Smith, hopefully this will answer some of your questions. They will be able to answer your questions.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Representative Roger, and Senator Smith.
Thank you.
Representative Ward, good seeing you folks. I really commend you for being here today. And I thank you for the opportunity to address you. We have presented some documents, supporting documents, and some of the stuff that I want to talk about. But basically, it's my job here as an advocate, representing the Broward Behavioral Health Coalition. We're supporting the FIT and CAD team expansion. These multidisciplinary teams that treat and provide support to families and keep children and youth at home and divert them from institutionalization. We support the expansion of the CSU, the Crisis Stabilization Units. I mean, you've heard me many times up there in Tallahassee. I guess I'm preaching to the choir. This will extend acute care beds. And we ask that you support the recommendation from the Baker, Marshman, and Wilkins. Some diversion enhancements funding include the transition vouchers. This will provide flexibility our flexible consumer direct voucher for individuals transitioning from acute and restrictive level of care to lower level of community care. Reinvestment grant, you're all familiar with it, and it involved a lot of the, about 18 counties, and the criminal justice, mental health, substance abuse involved individuals to divert them from criminal justice system. We're trying to get them at the front door rather than at the back end, you know? And we've talked about this many, many years ago. But it, sometimes it takes like maybe 100 years to get somewhere. We support the forensic hospital diversion pilot and the multidisciplinary team to divert individuals from forensic commitment. Whether, you know, it costs a lot of money to keep them in prison, and there's a lot of new and more, more reliable ways of doing the work in some cases. And we support the continuation of the Block Grant Authority. Actually, that's $20 million that is a non-recurring substance abuse and mental health block grant. I thank you for your consideration, and I'll let you touch up for a couple of minutes.
Okay, real quick. So my name is Sylvia Quintana, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Broward Behavioral Health Coalition, which is a managing entity for Broward County. We manage the DCF funds for behavioral health. First, I want to thank you for the family intervention team that you guys funded last year. Right. It's on its way almost out the door. We have our students.
Excuse me. Thanks. Sorry to interrupt you, Sylvia. We'll give you another minute to
please,
wrap up, please.
And the 15s are going to be doing a great job to assist families to keep their kids together, and so hopefully we'll be able to report on how well we're doing the next time that we meet. We also want to support the legislative budget request that the Department of Children and Families has put out. Pretty much it's a lot of the things that my colleague, Mr. Rocky Rodriguez, had mentioned to you. And that LDR is really important because Broward is mentioned in two of the governor's executive orders to be part of the pilot that will be changing the way we're doing community health community behavioral health services to really improve the quality of life of our people that have behavioral health so that they stop being involved in the criminal justice system or being homeless out there and be able to transition them from acute care to less acute care.
Okay.
So pretty much, we thank you. We hope that you can shepherd all of the funding back to Broward as you did last year.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. Thank you for your presentation. Thank you, Rocky, for yours. Questions from our legislators? Any questions? Senator Smith, did you have a question?
All
right. Okay. I noticed that, thank you very much. Commissioner Ed Phillips has joined us. Commissioner Phillips, we're very happy to have you here. Did you want to say something to us?
He told me he had something to say.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I have a budget review meeting, but I felt it would be robbery if I did not come by and thank you for being here. I thank you for bringing the delegation to the local community. It is important that the leaders of tomorrow see the leaders of today in their communities. And in behalf of the district of which I represent, District 4, thank you very much. And I beg your pardon as I must scurry to another meeting, but I thought it very important that I be present. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Phillips. We appreciate you attending. And moving right along, Dr. Stephen Rokin from Henderson Behavioral Health.
Hi, everybody. I really appreciate the privilege of being able to talk to you for a minute. I'm going to speak quickly. Basically, just quickly go over where we are relative to behavioral health funding right now. Some of the things that we could have done about it just this year and we passed on it. And what we could do right now to make up for that, okay? But first of all, thanks for being engaged and being here today. I wish the whole delegation was here. Everybody in this room, these are the folks who are champions of underserved, disadvantaged, disenfranchised people in Broward. And somebody has to pay attention, and we really appreciate you guys being engaged on this, so thank you. First of all, I just want to give you a sense where we are right now, quickly. Florida, as you know, is 49th. We're just about the worst in the country in spending on mental health. We're not just the worst, we're the worst by a lot. So I want to just give you a little context, and I'm not going to belabor it. California spends $152 a person, right? They're the most populated state in the country. New York is the fourth most populated state. They spend $256 a person. Texas is the third most populated state. They used to be the 49th ranked state in spending on mental health. Now they moved up to the middle of the pack because 2 years ago, the legislature invested $300 million in return dollars because they got smart and they knew what the return on investment would be. Florida is 49th. We spend $39 a person. So the people in this room do pretty amazing things in spite of horrific, catastrophically underfunded system. What we could have done, two really big things this year to do something about that. One, and the obvious one, it was teed up for us, and I know you guys understand that, we could have simply expanded Medicaid. That would have saved over a million lives in Broward County, would have insured all those folks, would have expanded access for people to get mental health and addiction services in an epic, historic way. We have let that go again and again. We know it's just a matter of time, and hopefully that's going to be expanded, if not this session, soon after. We also passed on federal legislation that, by the way, was co-sponsored by Congressman Deutsch and Senator Rubio, had bipartisan support, and that was the Federal Excellence, the Federal Excellence in Mental Health Act, which would have gave us parity in reimbursement in community mental health. So right now, we're discriminated against. Federally qualified health care centers are reimbursed on a prospective payment system. Without getting too far in the weeds, that means they're reimbursed for costs. Community mental health organizations, they're reimbursed through Medicaid for about 60% of the cost. That's discriminatory and illegal. If we had applied for the Federal and Excellence Mental Health Act funding, we would have made up for that. 26 states did apply. Florida let it go. So finally, if you give me one more minute, we let those two things go. What we can do about it right now is, and our main, at least through the Florida Council on Community Mental Health, and I agree with this wholeheartedly, is we need to increase Medicaid rates. Medicaid rates haven't went up in over a decade. They pay for about 60% of the costs. Providers are not going to be able to continue. I'll be happy to share with you later on what's happening in the system right now and how it's going to come apart. That would cost about $45 million in recurring general revenue, which would bring down about $67 million in federal trust funds for a total of about $112 million, which would raise the rates for probably the sixth most common services that underserved people get through the mental health system. So that's all I have for you today.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Members, questions? Senator Smith?
We're good.
Everyone's good? Thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Being here.
Thank you.
All right. The next person is Jennifer Braystick. Alzheimer's Association Southeast Florida.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Smith, Representatives. Thank you for allowing me to address you today. My name is Jennifer Braystead, and I'm the Advocacy and Public Policy Coordinator for the Southeast Florida Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. I am honored to be with you all today, here with you today on World Alzheimer's Day. On behalf of caregivers and individuals living with Alzheimer's disease, we thank you for your commitment to support caregivers and families and to help eliminate this devastating disease. Unfortunately, our state of Florida is at the epicenter of the Alzheimer's epidemic. It is estimated that over 500,000 Floridians are living every day with Alzheimer's disease, with over 50,000 here in Broward County alone. I have no doubt that each of us here has been touched by this devastating disease. The Florida legislature has made great strides, however, more needs to be done. We must increase respite services and other important healthcare initiatives to combat Alzheimer's, the sixth leading cause of death in America. As we know, having the disease isn't the only tragedy. We lose far too many caregivers due to stress. It is estimated that more than 1 million Floridians are providing unpaid Alzheimer's care. The stress and responsibility of Alzheimer's caregiving is overwhelming our families and simultaneously bankrupting our healthcare system. With that said, the Alzheimer's Association recommends the following. We support the Department of Elder Affairs budget recommendation of an additional $1.7 million for Alzheimer's respite services. Increased funding will continue taking individuals off the waiting list for respite care. We recommend enhanced dementia training as this is central to quality care in our state. From 2001 to 2003, we spearheaded new laws that required dementia training in nursing homes, adult daycare, home health, and hospice. In 2016, we now work to increase the quality of these standards. We recommend increased multicultural care and outreach. Studies show African Americans are twice as likely and Hispanics are 1.5 times as likely to develop Alzheimer's than Caucasians. We need to do a better job of reaching out to our communities and to provide awareness. The Alzheimer's Association will work to partner with the Department of Elder Affairs, Department of Health, and the Department of Children and Families to develop a public campaign that will promote dementia-specific initiatives for Hispanic and African American families. We recommend continued support for Alzheimer's research. We support the funding of the Ed and Ethel Moore Alzheimer's Disease Research Program, as we know it is the only way through research that a cure will be found. And finally, we recommend a healthcare plan for early diagnosis. A study this year showed that less than half of the people with Alzheimer's were diagnosed in time to allow them as patients and their families to put together a support plan. Families need guidance so they won't be devastated financially, physically, and emotionally, trying to take care of their loved ones with Alzheimer's. The Alzheimer's Association will work to implement a statewide awareness campaign.
Thank you. Members, questions?
Anyone? Question.
Yes.
Can you compare the funding that you got in the budget that was in the budget for Alzheimer's care, any type of Alzheimer's services?
Well, last year, through ADI, we received $1 million. So we're asking for a $1.7 million increase.
Was there an increase from previous years? Because I know the chairman of that committee,
right,
his family member, you know, have Alzheimer's, so that is a love of his, and he
right.
tells me all the time he has increased funding
Absolutely.
Over these years.
Yes. I believe in years past it was around $2 or $3 million, but I'm not sure offhand.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. And, you know, Alzheimer's is a big thing here in the state of Florida. You know, we have the largest senior population in the United States, I think, if we are getting right up there.
And younger folks,
are getting it as well. Dementia is something that has no age boundaries at this time, that we know of now. We see that. Thank you very much for your presentation. All right. Next is Broward Regional Health Council, Planning Council, Regina Kensky.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Regina Kensky with Broward Regional Health Planning Council. I'm Division Director. I'm here today to share with you a bit about Broward Regional Health Planning Council based on our annual report last year. We are a nonprofit here in Broward County, established since 1982 in the Florida statute. And we have managed several coordinated public health planning efforts in the community for almost 3 decades. We work with many partners here in the room today, and we with a budget, an annual budget of over $100 million, we deliver direct service programs that serve the uninsured, the underinsured, low-income Broward County residents. Our programs include maternal child health, school readiness, housing assistance, forensic reintegration, transforming our community's health, chronic disease self-management program for seniors, housing assistance, health insurance continuation, HIV and AIDS, to name a few. And so with our staff of over 200 individuals who speak multiple languages, we're able to provide these services. We have staff who speak Spanish, Creole, French, Portuguese. Just a few highlights from this past year. We conduct community health needs assessments for hospitals based on new IRS requirements, where we look at a variety of data sets, both quantitative and qualitative data. We oversee the Nurse Family Partnership Program, which is a nurse home visitation program funded by MSD dollars at the state level. And we have the crisis intervention training, where we educate law enforcement officers on how to de-escalate and deal with situations when dealing with mental health individuals with mental health issues in the community. We also work with veteran families, and we have the CDC grant for named partnerships to improve community health, dealing with policies and systems and environmental improvements to address major risk factors for disease and chronic conditions. We also work with the HIV population, and we oversee the centralized intake and eligibility determination for individuals with HIV and AIDS. More recently, we were awarded the early learning school readiness program for VPK, and we are working to get this off the ground, and it's been going very well.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Members, are there any questions? Senator Smith? Rep. Rogers? Rep. DeBose? All right. I just have a question for you. I'm listening to your services that you provide, and I want the members to kind of tune in on this. I'm hearing the same services kind of being provided by other organizations. So my question to the legislative delegation as well is, do we need to look at duplication of services and spending our dollars much wiser, being smart with our money a little bit more? Not saying that you're not doing a good job with what you're doing, but this is something that I hear when I'm hearing presentations that you're doing some of the same things that others are doing. Okay. So can you clarify that?
I'm happy to answer that. We work in collaboration with a lot of the partners who are presented before us and those who will present after us. The BBHC is one of our funders. The Children's Services Council funds us for the Healthy Families Program. We have several partnerships, and we like to work in collaboration because Broward County is collaboration county. And so there's a lot more collaboration than duplication. I think something you'll see. We work with Henderson Behavioral Health. We work with all of the partners that are here today. So you'll see a lot of collaboration. We like to develop programs in collaboration. 211 is one of our partners. They are the front line for a lot of the programs that we provide the community. So we definitely work together.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you for the support.
You're welcome. Next is Jason King, AIDS Healthcare Foundation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senator Smith, and Representatives Rogers and DuBose. My name is Jason King. I represent AIDS Healthcare Foundation's advocacy team. And here to speak with you today to express our support for three things. House Bill 81, which was recently introduced by Representative Edwards, and also its companion bill sponsored by Senator Brennan, which relates to the Needle Exchange pilot program in Miami. It's a very important bill that we hope passes this year. I believe it's third or fourth iteration, so we hope for your support on that bill. Secondly, the conversion therapy bill, House Bill 137, being sponsored by Representative David Richardson. It's very important that we try to curb this practice. There is a high correlation between conversion therapy and homeless gay youth, and we now know that 1 in 4 homeless youth becomes HIV positive. So there's a direct correlation to conversion therapy and HIV infection. And then, of course, we would support vehemently Medicaid expansion, and we know that everyone here on the dais supports that effort. Two other things that I'd like to discuss in greater detail. Mail order pharmacy. I know that this group is very familiar with what's going on in relation to insurers forcing patients into mandatory mail order pharmacy benefits. We are opposed to mandatory pharmacy mail order pharmacy benefits for the HIV population. It's important that medications are adhered to by HIV patients every single day. It's required for them to take it in a timely way, and sometimes this is impeded by this practice, and also simply privacy. Medication is oftentimes dropped off at the door or with family members, and a patient's status is disclosed to that person inadvertently. Another major topic that we would like to present to you again today, I know we have spoken to you all about this before. The Broward Wellness Center is a partnership organization with the Department of Health here locally that was doing a really good job and had, I'll be really quick, and I know I've talked to you about this before, had a reduction in funding given to it as of late. We are asking that the legislature and of course the delegation here, look into augmenting funding to STD services in Broward. We're also working with the Broward County Commission to try to see if they can explore ways to offset those funding losses as well. So kind of a multi-pronged approach.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Any questions?
I have one question.
Yes, Representative Bose.
In regards to House Bill 137, you've given a statistic. Did
yes.
you say 1 in 4 homeless youth end up being HIV positive?
One, I should clarify that, excuse me, 1 in 4 gay homeless youth. So LGBT homeless youth, 1 in 4. In some statistics, some studies, that's actually been higher than that. About 1/3 of that population becomes HIV infected. Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Next on the agenda is Brian Quayle. Yes. Brian Quayle, Boys and Girls Club of Broward County.
Madam Chair, members of this delegation, good evening. Boys and Girls Club of Broward County this year is celebrating its 50 years of serving the community. 12,620 kids we served last year, 704,000 visits, 2.9 million hours they spent in our clubs here in Broward. Our programs, plethora of programs. Homework health, math and reading, culinary arts, fine arts, education nutrition, SAT prep, public speaking, computer skills, college, career, construction programs, to name but a few. The Boys and Girls Club of Broward County was also the first after-school program in the state of Florida, and the first Boys and Girls Club in the state of Florida to enact the after-school meal program. Since 2011, over 3,040,000 meals have been served. We're proud to say that Senator Smith, Representative DeBose, Representative Jones are products of the Boys and Girls Club of Broward County. Also want to recognize Representative Reed, Rogers, Jacobs, and Senator Sobel, who have had connections with our clubs and have been very instrumental in helping us over the years. However, I want to center now on the 40 organizations that serve our state. The Florida Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs. 11 of those clubs are on military bases. One is on a Native American reservation. 229 clubs, 129,000 youth last year. The numbers are pretty impressive. Our alumni are pretty impressive. But to tell you the truth, last year we got our clocks cleaned. We went from $10.5 million in state appropriation down to $5.5 million. Here in Broward, we went from $750,000 to $361,000. You forgot the kids.
Right.
And we really need your help this year. We need our delegation to get behind us. Because right now, last year, we had 800 members in math and reading programs. This year, we're only going to probably serve about 400. My staff and I are working very hard, along with my board chair, Tim Ratty, who's here tonight, Paul Lopez, vice chair of our board here tonight, and we're really trying to work hard to keep those 800 members coming back. Addition, in our programs with DJJ, we had 1,500 members last year. That'll be cut down to 786. 100 members in our gang prevention program gets cut to 55. So, within your packets, you have our request. I ask you, I implore you, to please help us this year and to make this your number one priority in serving kids in the state. Unfortunately, when it came down to the last days of the session, we were lost. We were lost. And as I see the senator, I see the representative, you're who we talk about in our clubs, who we tell our kids to emulate. We really would like to see you all come to our clubs. We've designated September as Broward County Delegation Month. And we would love to have you just come in, see the kids, mm-hmm. see the programs, because that's what it's about. And I know I'm probably speaking to the choir here, but at the same time, you know members in other delegations. Every Boys and Girls Club in this state is doing what we're doing here tonight and going to their delegations. We're in 60 of 67 counties here in Florida. We make an impact. We serve the kids who nobody else is lined up with on a daily basis. $15 membership fee here in Broward County. That's it for the entire year. We go out and raise the rest of the money. With that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Brian. And members, Senator Smith?
First, Brian, thank you for all you do, especially the kids in our district. It's funny, I know when the members looked in their packet and saw this, it looks familiar. We get these every other day during the budget sessions. They serve the person who's in the best geography to office with these requests for volunteer cards. One thing that you mentioned earlier, and I wanted to highlight, we had a conversation earlier about the lunch programs and stuff. I wanted to highlight, you do dinner.
Yes.
In our communities, and I can say, because over at Nan Knox, which is down the street from my house, you not only give dinner to the kids that are there, but you love a lot of them, you know, take a bag home or something for parents even, who don't have dinner at home, so.
We don't do the parents, but on Saturdays, we supply the kids with backpacks of Sunday that come to the club, due to the generosity of the Moran Foundation that keeps our doors open on Saturday. And we are able to feed the kids on Saturday through the after-school meal program during the school year.
Great. And I think that's a great program. I wanted to reiterate something you said earlier. We really need help with other members from around the state. This delegation has been solidly behind you. And I know this crew up here, when you sit there the last weekend, and on all of our wish lists at the top of the Boys and Girls Club, I just want to reiterate that you need to really focus statewide with other members around the state, and you know the three or four people we really need to get in front of, and have the kids' parents get in front of those members and contact those members to make sure we get those dollars back up.
Couldn't agree with you more. Senator, I want to go on record to thank you personally for your hard work both in last year and the year before that. You've always been there for us, and our board and our community knows that, and we tell people that, and we appreciate your hard work during the session, especially last year. You probably worked the hardest you ever worked, and unfortunately, you saw it happen to us, money than the year before.
I truly would like to call the name of the person that I see the most when I'm in Tallahassee. And that's that other staffer that is always in my office that I'm gonna start charging rent. And I think the last name is Corey. Is it Jack Corey? Is that the person's name on a rep clock?
Yes.
All right. And I think he's here in the room. And I see him in Tallahassee. He sleeps in the chamber. When we get to that committee meeting, he is always there before we even arrive.
And
so you have a strong advocate, and we do really appreciate that resource as we advocate and continue to ask for resources for our children, especially that after-school program and the Saturday program, because I know, and I go to the Boys and Girls Club in Lauderhill. Press the button.
No, it's there. It's still on.
In Lauderhill. Okay, in Lauderhill. I teach the kids how to put ketchup on those broccolis so they taste good. Because, you know, we don't like veggies.
Yes.
So we have to, you know, just tell your staff how to just throw stuff on it that makes it look good and taste a lot better.
We
went through that exercise.
We'll definitely bring back your secret. And I should say about Mr. Corey, Mr. Corey is also a club kid. He was a club kid. And that's why his passion is there. And that's why you see him so much each and every day during the session.
Thank you. Nice choice.
Thank you very much, Brian. And you know my service to the Boys and Girls Club here in Deerfield Beach. And I just want to say that I was very upset with what happened. And I know Jack was beating his brains out, one might say, trying to be sure that we got the funding for Boys and Girls Club that we need to have. So looking forward to working this year as we move forward with the budget process. And thank you very much for coming this evening.
Thank you.
Just my colleagues have pretty much said it all. And being an alumni, I too carry that same passion. And being a freshman to this process, I feel like I've seen Jack as much as they have. So his passion just resonates throughout Tallahassee. And I just want to put on the record that I'm there, but for the Boys and Girls Club, you would not have Representative Bobby DeBose. And I want to make sure that there are plenty more representatives to represent the community that come through the Boys and Girls Club. So I'll definitely be around this September and come and visit.
Great. In the back of your letter, in your packet, each one of you has the location of the club that's nearest to you. So looking forward to seeing you. Thank you all.
Thank you very much, Brian. At this time, I'm going to call Ms. Dr. Richard Weisman from the Florida Poison Control.
Madam Chair, members of the Broward delegation, my name is Dr. Richard Weisman, and I'm the director of the Poison Control Center for South Florida that serves Broward County. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for the support of the Florida Poison Control Network. The network statewide consists of three interlinked poison centers, one in Tampa, one in Jacksonville, one in Miami. The network together answers about 188,000 calls per year, which is roughly 500 poisonings per day in the state of Florida. These are calls coming from the home and calls coming from our emergency departments throughout the state. Poisoning is the third most common form of unintentional death in the United States. In any given year, there are between 2 and 4 million poisonings. One in every 75 citizens in the United States will be victims of poisoning. 60% of these exposures involve children between the age of 2 and 3 who were exposed to toxins. To date in Broward County, this year alone, we're up to over 11,000 poisonings and requests for information, sometimes from the parents of the 2 and 3-year-olds, sometimes from the elderly, who often get confused with their medications. Did I take the pill? Did I take it twice? Did I take my husband's medications? Mm-hmm. We're able to sort that out and usually come up with a very happy ending. Poison control centers are really our nation's primary defense against injury and death from poisonings. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The public, physicians in our emergency departments, our paramedics, can be in touch with the poison control center and speak with a physician, a nurse, or a pharmacist to get immediate help. And this immediate help often leads to a rapid diagnosis and the immediate initiation of appropriate therapy, and usually a very, very good outcome. One of the unique things about poison control centers is that about 75% of the calls that we receive can be managed in the home without an ambulance trip or without a visit to the emergency department. And this results in a tremendous savings in the state. We've opened up a brand new website that is actively tracking this data. And with the $4 million investment that we have statewide, we've already saved over $100 million this year. This year, we're asking for an additional $500,000 to be shared among the three poison
control centers. We're going to allow you 1 more minute.
And we hope that you will look favorably upon this request. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you very much, Dr. Weisman. Dr. Weisman, I have a question for you also, but I'm going to let Rep. Rogers ask her question first.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, thank you very much. I think this is one of the best kept secrets in our community, this poison control center. And not everyone will be on the internet, but the telephone contact information I know is widely used. And I can share one story with you. You know, we have our seniors on their fixed medication, and then they're taking these bush doctor pills. And, we all grow up on our own medicine. And one day she called and she said, I took a pill and I drank some of this tea bush, right? And the next thing, she was having serious issues. So the line was called and we figured out the medicine bush was interacting negatively with one person
prescribed by the doctor.
So we need to talk to our own parents about all these medicines from back home mixing in with the one from the doctor's office, all right? That is major in our families. Yeah. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
I have a question as to where does your funding come through? Who actually provides the funding for the poison control?
the funding is coming from the Department of Health through the three parent hospitals, University of Miami, Jackson Memorial Hospital, Tampa General, and Shands Jacksonville. That money is immediately divided up and used for the operation of the three centers, which are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, there's a leaf that is on one of your flyers. I'm very involved with this. Do you know the name of this plant? We would like to, if you could
identify that plant that's on the brochure. I've been trying to find out what that is.
This one right here?
Yes.
I believe that's just poison ivy.
That's what that is?
Yeah.
Okay. It looks like something else to me.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weissman. All right, everybody. Okay, at this time we're going to call up Ken Reinhart from the AARP.
I don't know what to talk about.
Oh, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the delegation. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Ken Reinhart. I'm a volunteer with AARP, and I'd like to touch briefly on the issues that we're going to be advocating for in this upcoming regular session. The first one is home and community-based services. We would like to see additional funding and additional rebalancing of funding from institutional care to home and community-based services. It's a win-win for everybody. We'd like to see it happen more. There's still long waiting lists out there. We'd like to keep pushing for that. Caregiving is becoming a bigger issue for more of us. It's estimated there are about 2.8 million caregivers in the state of Florida alone, providing about $29 billion of care for free. And often this is at their own personal expense, up to and including having to quit work to stay home 24/7 and care for a loved one. So what we're looking for is resources and support to care for the caregivers going forward. We see that being a bigger issue as time goes on. Telehealth is a major opportunity for us, especially for those who live in rural areas. Technology is doing wonderful things on a daily basis. Patients can be monitored. This applies more appropriately in our area for long-term care, where patients can be monitored and communicated with remotely. It saves them the travel costs, provides an opportunity for earlier diagnosis and observation of issues that can be dealt with before they become even a greater issue at all. In the area of work and save, many states have already initiated legislation on this and are working on it. We're proposing increased access to private and public retirement savings programs. And lastly, we'd like to see more transparency to the Public Service Commission and enhanced ratepayer protections. One specific that we're interested in is eliminating PSC settlements without the consent of the Public Counsel for cases in which the Public Counsel is appearing. So, there are many more listed on there, and obviously we don't have the time.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Do we have any questions? Yes.
Not to get too technical, but on the last issue, the PSC settlements, did you say with the consent of the council or without notification to the public council?
I'm sorry.
The PSC settlements, the last issue you brought up, eliminating or I guess shedding some sunlight on the settlements of the PSC, you said, is it with the consent of the public council or just notification to the public council?
Yeah, there were issues in the recent past here where the public council had comment on it, and that was not heard when it should have been. So what we're advocating for is that they do have the ability to be heard in cases where it's appropriate.
Okay.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I'm also looking at your safeguarding revenues dedicated to affordable housing, and I can share with you from the delegation's insurance committee what are some of the concerns from that committee as it relates to our seniors not, who are living in their own homes, not having insurance, can't afford the insurance, need help with hardening their homes so that they can qualify for low-rate insurance. So as you do your list of things that can be looked at and should be looked at, I would like for the AARP to include that as a major concern, because a lot of your seniors do not carry insurance because they can't afford it, and they can't afford to fix up or harden their homes to be able to afford insurance. So we need to make that a priority, and that is one of mine.
I will make sure that's heard. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Bose, did you have a question?
My question is on your telemedicine, and who are the providers of this telemedicine service? Are these providers only in the state of Florida, or are these providers from everywhere?
Now, they're around the country. It's a new business, so they're out there, and it would be our charge to find appropriate ones and make that happen.
So what you're saying to me is that doctors who do not have licenses for the state of Florida are able to provide these telemedicine services. Is that correct?
That would be up to you. Obviously, that would have to be regulated, and whatever system would be put in place would have to include that, certainly.
Thank you very much for that comment.
Next
on the agenda, Cindy Arenberg-Seltzer of the Children's Services Council. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the delegation. It's always a pleasure to see you. As you know, the Children's Services Council, Cindy Arenberg-Seltzer, CEO of the Children's Services Council. I don't come before you seeking anything for the Children's Services Council, but I do have to support those budget requests that were made earlier in support of child welfare, in support of the Boys and Girls Club. We know how critical all of those and the mental health services, all of those are. The Children's Services Council does what we can to provide those prevention services. As you heard from Ms. Borsuch, nearly $10 million in services to help keep children in their homes, out of the foster homes, if they can do so safely. It's a challenge all the time to look for that balance of the primary prevention to keep them from ever having that call into the hotline in the first place, and then providing services for those where there's been a call to the hotline, but where there isn't enough evidence to remove them. And about 50% of the children who are served in our family strengthening programs fall into that category of there's been a call to the hotline, but we think they can stay home safely. We continue to partner with the department and with ChildNet to look for ways to maximize the effectiveness of those programs. And in fact, this year the council has made the decision, and our second trim hearing is coming up, but I see no reason why this would change, to take advantage of the increase in property values. We're leaving the millage rate the same, which is going to allow us to invest another $4 million approximately in additional services, some of that going into family strengthening, adding a couple of new models, including one at the Boys and Girls Club, to give them a little bit more of a comprehensive family strengthening program within their club structure. I also wanted to answer, also some additional after-school and summer programs, as well as some of the other areas that we're working. You had asked earlier about the rate for VPK, and while I always hesitate to correct Dr. Weinstein, I know she was just pulling a number out, and I confirm that it's actually $2,437. Mm-hmm. And I make that point because since VPK was started, that rate was started at $2,400, was cut, okay, and then recently $25 was added. Mm-hmm. So it is still abysmally low and has certainly not taken up for inflation.
One minute, Cindy.
I want to tell you also, when it comes to hunger, there's a proposal around, and I'm not sure if this is legislative, I'm sorry, I was trying to confirm that, but to allow for the Department of Agriculture, who currently can approve the summer feeding programs, the summer break spot sites, that has no jurisdiction in the after school arena where the Department of Health is, and that is really difficult The paperwork coming out of the Department of Health is very challenging, and Mr. Putnam is asking for the authority to allow his approval of the summer programs to go year-round, and that would help dramatically with that issue.
Okay.
And there are several other things I could tell you about, but you don't have time.
Thank you very much, Cindy, for your presentation. And we will definitely be looking at children's services. That's our most important thing that we have to do in the legislature is look at our future.
Okay, may I ask?
Yes.
May I add one more thing?
But just quickly.
CMS. This is another technical thing. It's not going to cost you any money. But right now, Children's Medical Services, they're not allowed to market their services. And that is having a devastating effect on families who have children with special needs born. It used to be in the hospitals, they could tell the families about Children's Medical Services, and now it is considered just another health plan, and therefore they're not allowed to market it. And this is a big problem. Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for sharing that. That question, can we market it? If they are not allowed to, as an agency independent, can you market? You are seeing the children, you're having the encounter. What can you do? We're looking for solutions other than for the state.
So we do what we can, but I think the important part is that the hands are tied of the people who are really in contact with the children. And so if the distinction can be made about education versus marketing, they don't have to, but they've been told they can't discuss it at all. And that is tragic. So the advocacy we've been doing is to say, let them educate about the availability of the program and its advantages for, because it covers a lot more than the plan.
Okay. Oh boy. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you.
It's crazy.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming for us now is Cliff Bauer from the Miami Jewish Health System.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's my privilege to stand before you this afternoon and talk to you about Miami Jewish Health Systems. We're celebrating our 75th anniversary this year of serving the community of Southeast Florida, primarily Miami and Broward County. Since for the last 10 years, we've had 278 low-income HUD 202 housing units in Pembroke Pines. More importantly, thanks to the support of the legislature 2 years ago, next in January, we'll be opening our fourth PACE center and the first in Broward County down in Miramar. PACE stands for Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. It serves individuals who are over the age of 55 and who are clinically eligible to go into a nursing home. How effective is it? Nationally, or in the state of Florida, let me go back. State of Florida, approximately 45% of those in Medicaid individuals who the state has deemed clinically eligible to go into a nursing home live in a nursing home today. 45% statewide. It's 40% of that population in Broward County, paid for by the state at an average cost of about $65,000 to $67,000. In the PACE program, which costs the state approximately, in Broward County, it will cost the state approximately about $20,000 a year. Our population in PACE, we have 480 participants in the program, and less than 3% live in a nursing home. The rest live in the community. PACE is a medical home model that is an adult daycare center. And we're this coming year, one of our priorities for this coming legislative session is that we are coming back to the legislature to ask to allow us to continue to expand that program. PACE is a zip code service area limited program. We want to move up into northern Broward County, the Pompano Beach, Margate, Tamarack area. It's a huge need for that population in that area. We need funding, we need authorization to move in there by the legislature, and then we need funding for the Medicaid slots. And of that $20,000, the state's only on the hook for 40% of that because Medicaid pays 60%. So again, we'll be talking to you all during this coming session about that. Second thing that we're on asking for is Alzheimer research. We very much appreciate
that support.
That we have, that you all have shown. We currently have 26 medical research studies going on at Miami Jewish, and we're very appreciative of your continued support in finding some way to help people who suffer from Alzheimer's. And last, thank you all for what you do. It's a tireless, many times thankless job, but we do appreciate all your efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bauer. Are there any questions for...
When I reviewed my agenda and I saw Miami Jewish Health System Life, and I'm saying, why are you in front of a Broward delegation? So maybe when you move into Broward County, if you're not currently already here, it could be Miami / Broward County Jewish Health System.
I will take that back for a
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rev. Rogers. Anyone else with a question? All right, moving right along. Dr. Elizabeth Winters, Children's Harbor.
Good evening, members of the delegation. I'm here today to talk to you about the value of group care in child welfare. I know for those representatives that sit on the Children, Families, and Seniors Committees, there's going to be policy discussion around group care. And I want to tell you, for kids in foster care, one size does not fit all. It is so important for our kids that they have the ability to either remain home with their families, live with their relatives, live in a foster home, or live in a group home. Many of our kids, because of the traumas they have been through, have mental health and behavioral issues that prevent them from staying in a foster home. They also have attachment issues that precludes them sometimes from developing those attachments, mm-hmm. those bonds, and trusting adults. I come before you for my 31 kids that live in our group homes. Each one of them, the value of their having what every child should have, the love, the nurturing, the safety, the stability, and the structure. Those things are key for all kids, and those our kids get that at Children's Harbor. We keep 24 kids that are part of a sibling group, so brothers and sisters don't get separated, and we keep teen moms so that they learn how to parent their kids, and those kids don't come back into the system. So I want to make sure that you know that there are incredible group homes out there that provide great services. I want to share quickly with you a story about one of my teens. I have a young girl that came to us about 4 months ago. She is 15 years old, and she has cerebral palsy. She came with her younger brother. She told me her story. Mother has substance abuse issues. From a very young age, she was the parent for her younger brother, left to care for him with no diapers, no food, asking neighbors to help her when she was 6 years old. This child had surgeries on her legs, was left in a wheelchair. Mom could not care for her. She remembers thinking, I have to get out of this wheelchair because I have to take care of my younger brother. This young girl came to us broken. She has healed. She is so happy. She feels so safe. She knows who's going to be at her home when she gets home. She doesn't have to worry about taking care of her brother. She can be a child for the first time. And we'll tell you, yesterday we had an event at our facility. We had a cycling club out that gave new bikes to all of our kids. And for the first time ever, this 15-year-old learned how to ride a bike.
Wonderful.
And that's what these group homes do for you. And I hope you will come out to my facility. We have an open house on September 29th. I invite you all to come out and really see what we provide our kids and why they're so important.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Yes. At this time, we will move on. It's a Haley Belfato, American Cancer Society Action Network.
Yeah. My name is Haley Belfato, and I'm a volunteer with the American Cancer Society. I'm sorry, the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, also known as ACS-CAN. I'm here on behalf of our dedicated volunteers across Florida to briefly address our top priorities for the 2016 legislative session. I appreciate the opportunity to share these mission-critical issues with you today. Our first request is $2.6 million in dedicated dollars for the Mary Brogan Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program. This program, which serves thousands of medically underserved women between the ages of 55 and 64, continues to be underfunded and cannot meet the demands of our vulnerable, working poor populations who are often falling through the cracks. While the Florida legislature and Speaker Chris Afiuli earned our thanks for allocating a record $2.1 million for this program last year, the fact remains that only 6 out of every 100 eligible women are served at this funding level. Our funding request for the coming year represents a 50% match of the CDC's current program investment in Florida and will provide much-needed services for women in our state facing a possible cancer diagnosis. Secondly, we ask that you increase Florida's investment in biomedical research through the James and Esther King Biomedical Research Program and the Bankhead Coley Cancer Research Program, sorry. These programs were funded at $10 million each for 2015-2016, and we're asking that each be allocated an additional $5 million in the coming year. Each of these peer-reviewed and competitive research programs has a proven track record of success, which is helping to strengthen Florida's capacity to compete nationally for top-notch scientists and researchers. Additional funding would continue the great progress being made to save lives while offering the added benefit of creating high-quality jobs here in Florida. Our top priority is to raise the state's tobacco tax by $1.25. Florida's current tax ranks in the bottom half of all states and hasn't been increased since 2009. In fact, since Florida last raised its tobacco tax, 20 other states have increased their tobacco tax, and several have done so on multiple occasions.
Go right ahead, 40 seconds.
Because this is a tax that provides win-win-win solutions. It improves public health by decreasing smoking, especially among our youth. It produces substantial revenues to help improve the state address critical issues, including tobacco prevention and cessation. And it is a solution that is widely supported by your voters. More than 14 million packs of cigarettes are sold to kids in middle school and high school every year in Florida, according to the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. A simple $1.25 tax can mean this number will be drastically reduced, resulting in far fewer children to tobacco in the coming years. Thank you for your time. ACS CAN volunteers look forward to working with you in the coming months to meet the needs of our state's cancer patients, survivors, and caregivers.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your presentation. Are there any questions?
Yes, madam. Thank you. I needed to give you some more time because we're talking about kids and smoking, right? But then there are new forms of cigarettes, new things out there. Have you done any, do you have any numbers as to kids that are no longer doing or cigarettes and tobacco and doing this new smoke thing and all of that good stuff?
I know we're doing some research on the staff partners here. I don't know if we have numbers on that, but we are doing research on the vape pens.
Hi, so we are currently doing research.
Your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Natalie Pinay, and I'm the Florida Grassroots Manager for ACS CAN in Florida. And there's current research, and I can get those numbers to you and email that to your office.
Okay. Quick question, Madam Chair. Do you see a shift in kids going from tobacco or the norm to this new method?
There's less restriction on tobacco-less vapor smokers.
Right.
So I don't know if they're seeing a shift, but there is definitely an increase in youth users. And like I said, I can get those exact numbers to you, but there is less regulation on that.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you. Next on the agenda, Monica King and Emilio Benitez from Chalmers.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair and delegation, and thanks for having me. Just be me today. I'm Monica King. I'm the Executive Director of the Child at Broward office, and I think many of you already know that ChildNet is a community-based care lead agency responsible for our child welfare. So it's not just the case management of those kids, but we're also responsible for really every facet of their lives. And in a big part, that includes a residential placement. So I know we've had folks talk about group home providers, but it is all encompassing. So making sure that we're meeting their educational needs, their behavioral needs, their education, you know, their health needs is a big part of what we do. One, I just wanted to give thanks. Last year was the first time in 5 years that we received funding. We had been progressively losing funding for the last 5 years because of a methodology, a formula the state was using. So it was the first time that we had received some additional funds. And I think Ms. Gorsuch from the department already touched on the fact that in light of that time where we're losing funding,
the numbers have been increasing. In 2013, we had a total of 2,200 kids that we were caring for. This past June, it was 3,400 kids, total kids, about 2,200 that were out of, that had been removed from their parents. That is a phenomenal increase in the number of kids that have been coming into care. And we are struggling, really, the entire system is struggling to manage the influx of kids coming in. And it's not just our case managers whose caseloads are really just skyrocketing, but it's our judicial system, it's our children legal service system, it's our guardian ad litem program, and it's our residential providers that are really struggling. So we are grateful and appreciative of the support that we got last year, but we are operating at a fairly significant deficit. And we are working with the Department of Children and Families very closely. Our statewide association, the Florida Coalition for Children, works very closely with our secretary, with the secretary, and we are hopeful and we're wanting to sort of support what they're currently doing around not just increased funding for the community-based care agencies, if I could have one more minute, but also the funding for the substance abuse and mental health, because those are the driving factor that brings some of our kids into care are their parents who are using drugs. So we support the request for a CAT team, community action team. We support the request by the department for substance abuse mental health funding. And we hope that you will support the department's ask for community-based care lead agencies, because we really are just an incredible amount of strain.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any questions, comments?
Just kind of want to follow up, go back to my questioning about these numbers, because every time I hear them, they just blow me out of the water. Can you speak to, do you have any data or information as to, you know, the increase, the numbers? Like, why are the kids being removed? Is there something going on? We talked about mental health, substance abuse, incarceration. I heard a lot of things. Is there one variable moving more than the other? Is there any type of correlation? Just speak to that.
Well, historically, the top two issues have always been substance abuse and family violence or domestic violence. So the factors have not changed. We did notice here in South Florida, in Miami, Broward, and Palm Beach, we started experiencing this increase about 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, compared to the rest of the state. And, you know, there's been an analysis, there's been studies, and there hasn't been one factor other than we all do fall in the same media market. So there's been a lot of attention, there was a lot of coverage around some pretty significant cases that had happened. So there's sense to a lot of folks thinking that there's sort of that attention. There's a lot more calls. Broward does a lot more of calls to the hotline than a lot of other districts. We also verify cases at a higher rate than other districts. So there's not one thing that we can point to. We just know that the facts are that there's a lot more kids coming into care.
Just a follow-up. So has there been any type of change or best practices in regards to evaluating these cases? If the variables are the same, in regards to removing these kids. You know, we don't want them in a dangerous situation, but are we more conservative in our approach, or?
You know, I will say that we as a county do verify more cases than other counties do. Ken Borsich talked about we're going to bring Casey Family Programs in to really almost look at sample cases, look at their history, how many priors they had, like where was there an intervention that got missed at early in this child's life that we could have intervened? And sort of do an analysis of what more could this community do? Because we do have a lot of great community resources, but where are we missing? So we're hoping that they'll be sort of really look at a sample of cases and give us a better idea. Do we need more treatment? Do we just have a hotbed of parents that are, you know, addicted that we need to sort of address that issue? So.
Just one more. Sure. I think just kind of shifting because, I see here, and we'll probably be talking to you about a particular issue, but in regards to the residential group
care.
And with this increase, and I know there's only so many, that are available, at some point, we're going to have way more kids than we do have these facilities of different sorts. And that's where I'm concerned. I mean, there are some other issues that, you know, we get into that whole NIMBY, but at some point, we're going to run out of places to put these kids. And something's spiking. And from what I'm hearing, it's not even plateauing now. It's just continuing to rise. What is our discussion? What you know, DCF town, and talk to me, because it's very alarming.
It's very alarming. I think there's a couple of I mean, it could be a very lengthy topic about there are some youth that are coming into care that could be better served if they had been identified by the juvenile justice system and intervention will much earlier. There are some kids that are coming to us for mental health services that their parents aren't able to get, and they're really walking away from a child that has some significant behavioral health issues because they just don't know what to do anymore. I wouldn't say that was the preponderance, but we have a good number of kids whose parents have really just washed their hands because they're not getting the help that they need. I had two children the other day that from the delinquency bench got ordered into our care because the parents were scared. They didn't know what to do anymore with these youth. And so you are absolutely right. It's extremely alarming. We don't have the facilities as a dependency system to take care of these youth. And we really need to think about what kind of supports. The governor signed an executive order for DJJ and DCF to work together. And we have to think of a different way because we've got kids. Broward County is one of the counties that it takes twice as long to get to disposition on a delinquency charge than any other county in this state. And that's a tragedy because these kids are not getting the intervention that they need and really are coming involved in a crossover system. So there's a lot that needs to happen for our youth, our adolescents, our kids that don't get the behavioral health services. And then along the way, parenting, you know, kids, parents that have addiction issues. So it's alarming.
Just a quick follow-up. So with all that being said, in that, how can this delegation help with that issue? Not necessarily solve it because we need these updates.
Well, I think there's several things. One, the way we support this foster parents and what we can do to support and wrap around foster parents that are willing to take those really difficult teenagers. Today, a traditional foster parent gets $17 a day. Mm-hmm. That is nothing. So we have to really look at how we support our foster parents. We have to get juvenile justice system to the table and figure out how to co-mingle or co-fund programs that will meet the needs of that population. And we have to really speak to our behavioral health community about how we can better serve and provide treatment for some of our adolescent population so that parents aren't struggling to get them the access to behavioral health services that they're really struggling to get. Those are the three things that I would say you could be helpful.
Thank you very much for your presentation, and I didn't hear you speak to the human trafficking issue that we have here in Broward County. We'll take another night to do that. I understand that, but I do want folks to understand that we have a very large human trafficking problem here in Broward County. And there are things in place with your organization as well as with DCF now trying to take care of this new issue that we have. So thank you very much for your presentation. The next on our list is Paulette Perlowen. Advanced Practice Registered Nurses.
APR.
Yes. Hi.
I'm sorry. Pull it down.
Critically
tapped. Pull it down.
Just this better? Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She really made you short.
Short time.
Go right ahead.
I usually have time.
Hi, my name is Paulette Perlin. I am a psychiatric advanced practice registered nurse in the state of Florida. We are also called advanced registered nurse. We are called advanced registered nurse practitioners in Florida. I also chair an organization of South Florida psychiatric advanced practice nurses. I primarily see Medicaid patients. I also see some mental health court and drug court referrals, as well as some indigent patients referred to the court system at the place that I work. Some of you may understand this, what this becomes of a job, but I may be just a nurse practitioner. But I'm here to implore you to help me treat my patients as my patients deserve to be treated. I'd like to say hello to our esteemed legislators on the dais, as well as the esteemed speakers in the audience. I am in the company of, as I was listening to people present their talks tonight, I feel like I'm in the company of great leaders in South Florida and in Broward County. My request, however, is not for funding of what I do for an organization that I work with, but it will actually save the great state of Florida money, projected to save Florida up to $44 million annually for the Medicaid program. Many of the Broward legislators that here have supported advanced registered nurse practitioner expanded scope of practice to include prescribing scheduled medications, also known as controlled substances. Thank you for your past support, and I'm asking for your support again, or if you haven't given us support in the past, to give us your support now. I understand that again in 2016, Representative Signan and Senator Greenblade will submit their advanced practice nurse bills for prescribing privileges for controlled substances. I am asking for your support for those bills and to encourage your colleagues to support this as well. I and many of my advanced practice nursing colleagues treat Medicaid patients. These people suffer when waiting for prescriptions in the... They suffer when waiting for prescriptions in the mail or having to refer to an office for that prescription. Information in your packets was obtained over several years. It shows that we have the support of organizations such as the U.S. Governors Association, AARP, the Florida Medical Directors Association, and the Federal Trade Commission. In 2009, the Florida Senate commissioned its own study that absolutely supported removing prescribing limitations on advanced practice nurses. The Institute of Medicine also put out a large study that supported our prescribing privileges. Medications you would not think that our scheduled medications are, and advanced practice nurses cannot prescribe them. These include narcolepsy, headache, cough, restless leg, gastrointestinal muscle relaxants, and appetite medications, as well as your normal stimulants, benzodiazepines, and pain medicines. I hope in the 3 minutes I have that I've been able to share with you how our clients do suffer. I ask you to please help me help the vulnerable patients in our patient group and by supporting and helping to pass legislation permitting APNs, advanced practice nurses, to prescribe controlled substances. Finally, I would point out that Florida is the only state in the entire United States where advanced practice nurses can't prescribe controlled substances or scheduled drugs. To date, no state that has approved this has taken back prescribing privileges. We are allowed to prescribe in 49 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. Look at the map that I included in your packet. And I ask you simply, what is wrong with this picture?
Thank you. Questions?
Okay. I'm not a nurse. Barely understand all that you just said, but follow it closely. You have advanced registered nurse practitioners that was recently allowed to be able to prescribe certain controlled substances.
No, not
in the state of Florida.
Not in the state of Florida.
Every state in the United States except Florida, and that includes the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, advanced practice nurses can prescribe controlled substances. Florida is the only state in the United States that prohibits us from prescribing those medications. We can prescribe all other medications as long as there's a protocol with a physician.
What did you pass this past year that allowed nurses?
It was a Baker Act. That allows psychiatric advanced practice nurses to release Baker Acts on patients that are in receiving facilities. For any Baker Act that was made, except those made by psychiatrists, in that case, we have to communicate with the psychiatrist before we would be able to release the Baker Act. In the state of Florida, we're called ARNPs, Advanced Registered Nurse Practitioners. In the rest of the country, we're called APRs, Advanced Practice Registered Nurses.
So, follow Madam Chair, we did something for the ARNPs, but that only has to do with those Baker Act.
Yeah. Okay. We had legislation that was submitted in this year because the issue that happened
Thank you for taking on the responsibility. Well, when we had
a special session, the first special session for the funding situation, uh-huh. Our bill was one that made it into that special session.
But unfortunately, one
of the senators who controlled one of the committees refused to allow any health-related legislation to be heard. And that was it. I thought that one went through, honestly.
Okay, thank you.
Any other?
On the bill I proposed, you have the bill number?
I don't have the legislation numbers yet. I've been told
that
Senator Grimsley and Representative Pigman will be submitting legislation, but at this point I don't have access to any of the bill numbers or the content. I had spoken with Representative Clark Reed earlier, and I can forward that information on to her as soon as I get it.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions or comments?
I just want to make a statement because
the only registered nurse on the floor is my good friend Daphne Campbell, and she will advise us of whatever good legislation because she stood with Pigman on the floor on this bill.
She has been very
supportive. So I just wanted to give her credit for that.
Yes, she has been very supportive in the past. Actually, there's something
in your packet, yes, you'll find something.
That was a response to a request she made to the federal commission.
Awesome.
All right, thank you very much. Any other questions? Any? All right.
Thank you so much.
Come here.
Next on the agenda, Kadriana Young. For Healthy Food Florida on behalf of the American Heart Association.
You.
Hello, my name is Adrienne Young. I'm here today because there are over 63,000 Broward residents who live in low-income communities of color without access to fresh and healthy food. The United States Department of Agriculture recognizes those areas as food deserts, and unfortunately, they're very, very prevalent in South Florida. The consequences of food deserts are very, very well documented. A lack of access to fresh and healthy food leads to lifelong and chronic illnesses like diabetes, high blood pressure, and obesity. And these consequences have demonstrated an effect on our economic system, as well as exposes a lot of holes and failures in our public health systems. To be exact, it's 2.5 million people in Florida alone, and again, specifically 63,000 in Broward County. And I believe that we do have the resources to do better. And there is a specific initiative called the Healthy Food Financing Initiative. It was first started in Pennsylvania in 2004. And with the help of a state senator, their community redevelopment agency, as well as various nonprofits, they were able to secure $100 million from state appropriations, which went to create 88 food retail grocery stores. And that served 400,000 residents and also created 5,000 jobs. So in essence, the Healthy Food Financing Initiative is an economic development tool that is used to foster entrepreneurship in low-income areas that have low percentage of entrepreneurship. And it secondarily also serves to solve those public health issues about the gaps in access to fresh and healthy food. The American Heart Association is spearheading the effort to bring the Healthy Food Initiative to Florida. And on September 10th, I believe, Representative David Santiago and Representative Larry Lee filed House Bill 153 that sets to get the Healthy Food Financing Initiative created in the state of Florida.
There has been a lot of fantastic health promotion work being done at the grassroots level by nonprofits in both Miami-Dade County as well as Broward County. And we just want this initiative to be an anchor to uplift that work and fund it. There are so many faith groups, there's so many nonprofits that already have things like community gardens and farmers markets. But farmers markets are not open from 9 to 5, 7 days a week. And unfortunately, we have high percentages of two very vulnerable populations, the elderly and children. So we need to make sure that we have as much access as possible so that we are protecting the livelihood of children.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And we will look into, you said that's House Bill 153. Larry Lee and Santiago, Lee and Santiago, thank you very much for that information. Are there any questions, members? Thank you very much for your presentation. Next on our agenda is Michael Rayner.
Hi, good evening. This question is from Michael Rayner. I'm a gay man living with HIV here in Broward, as many of you know. My comment's probably more directed to the senators, and I know that Senator Smith is the only one present right now in the Senate side. And it's Surgeon General John Armstrong last session. I'm actually pleased that his confirmation did not go through, and you'll be having hearings for that this coming session. And unfortunately, the Senate does not have someone who's openly gay or someone who is living with HIV/AIDS, at least none that we are aware of publicly. And I would very much appreciate if some representation from these two communities in particular are put before the Surgeon General during his confirmation hearings in the committee or on the Senate floor. Because I think he, quite honestly, while I pray for his recovery from his colon cancer surgery that he just had on Friday, my mother passed from cancer, so I mean no disrespect to him. I don't know what his department under his leadership has even done to encourage men to get colorectal screenings on a regular basis, especially over in the age of, I think, 45 is when they're recommending it, which I've actually been having to do because of HIV since the age of 26. You know, but under his leadership, Florida continues to lead the nation, number one, with new HIV infections. Nothing is being done. The use of PrEP, which is Truvada, so far that I have heard of all the studies, not one person on it has contracted HIV and has become incredibly effective. His views do not represent that of the entire state and the people that make up the state and the great diversity that we have. I know that right now he's challenging in court the lawsuit over birth certificates for same-sex parents to have both of their names listed on birth certificates. I know that his office also was one that appealed in the rulings on marriage equality. His deputy chief operating officer, Nathan Dunn, actually used to work for John Stemberger. That organization is responsible for some rather homophobic statements in their amicus briefs on marriage equality. And it just identifies the culture that we have in the state in charge of the health for all people, and it's not representative of that. You know, I really wish that during his hearings you would ask him, what does he actually plan to do? What innovative steps to decrease HIV infection for all populations, but more specifically among gay men, which is a population that he is unwilling to speak about. He and the governor have never, I'm wrapping up now, he and the governor have never once publicly spoken on HIV/AIDS. World AIDS Day actually is the same as the governor's birthday, and the governor has never even issued a proclamation for World AIDS Day like that of Charlie Crist and Jeb Bush. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rayner, for your comments. Senator Smith, did you have something?
Yeah, if you can just email, and I'm sure, are you going to come up for the hearing? If
we give you time. You know, because I drive up, I'm not a lobbyist. I don't have big pockets to just jump on a plane, and it is required. I just drove to the panhandle for an HIV conference this weekend, so I'm actually exhausted. I wasn't even sure if I was coming tonight. If as long as I have advance notice, I certainly will try to make it up there.
Well, I can say, I can do, yeah, have my email address. Any questions you want posed please get them to me. I think he would come up before Health and Human Service Appropriations also, right?
There's several, I think it goes through like three or four committees.
Yeah, I was saying that the process. Health and Human Service Appropriation, he'll come in front of.
Right, the only unfortunate thing is usually there's only about 2 days' notice
right.
before those mm-hmm. things. Sometimes it happens less than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure.
So getting up from Broward, as you know, mm-hmm. I know that I've sat in the airport in a taxi with Representative Clark Reed several times on layover flights, so I know it's a burden for you as legislators yes. to get to Tallahassee.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much. Mr. Reina was our last presenter for the evening, or speaker for the evening. At this time, members, I have to have you identify yourselves for the record, because we didn't really have a roll call when we came in. So, would you do that at this time?
Bobby DeBose, Representative Bobby DeBose, District 94.
Representative Gwen Clark Reed, House District 92.
Hazel Rogers, Representative, District 95.
Christopher Smith, Senate District
31.
31.
Are you sure?
Same many times.
You sure? Okay.
All right. Thank you for your participation and interest this evening. Our next public hearing will be on Thursday, September the 24th, from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Sunrise Civic Center Ballroom. 10610 West Oakland Park Boulevard. There we will be hearing issues from our constitutional offices, as well as pertaining to issues pertaining to criminal and juvenile justice. So please, if you have interest in those particular hearings, please be there. That's this next Thursday, September 24th. A full schedule of public hearings and workshops is available on the table in the back. I did want to say to you that I now have a new legislative assistant, and I wanted to introduce Eric Gooden. Eric, would you raise your hand so they'll know who you are in my office? And also to introduce Andrea Knowles, who is the new executive director at the Legislative Delegation Office. So these are the persons that you will need to be in touch with. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I truly think we need to recognize those members who have their staff here. Like I see Devon Campbell, and I think he is
with
Representative Chevron Jones, and
staff is here too.
Representative Rogers' staff is here as well.
Yes.
And JJ was here from Senator Ring's office. Okay. Kim has all of her class, social work students here from FAU. Please, let's acknowledge them. Thank you. Looking forward to have you in the workforce soon. Okay. Anyone else? Anything else in the good of the order?
Thank you. Meeting adjourned.
Other than that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.